cooking lessons from a neighbor to learn to cook American fare for Schinner's father. Schinner went vegetarian for ethical reasons, and eventually transitioned to veganism for health reasons while living in Japan again after college. She had developed a passion for French and Italian cuisine at this stage in her life, so she decided to apply the lessons she learned from those areas to plant-based baking and, eventually, cheesemaking after a long series of entrepreneurial successes and failures in the animal-free food industry. Now, she uses bacteria cultures to ferment nuts, to break their sugars down into acids in the same way bacteria are used in animal-based cheese production. That's the main difference between plant-based and animal-based cheese production. Whether the fats, proteins, and carbohydrates you begin the process with are from an animal's milk or a plant ingredient like a nut. The choice of bacteria, the duration of the aging, and additions of vegetable starches or fats allow her to produce a wide variety of cheeses, many closely emulating well-known cheeses like mozzarella and brie. As of February 2017, Schinner was producing 100,000 rounds of cheese a month and was planning to release versions of the company's cheese that would match the average animal-based cheese more closely in both price and nutritional content. However, Schinner sees her company as kind of like Tesla. Tesla first came out with its premium Roadster several years ago and is only recently lowering its price point. Miyoko's Kitchen will eventually produce cheaper block cheeses than the artisanal rounds it makes today, but even these will always be higher-end foods. She told me they'll never make cheese shreds or slices, and the ingredients will always be organically sourced. Schinner and I agree that in order to effect big changes in our food system, we will need a diversity of companies and approaches, just like it is in the existing dairy industry. There will be high-end and medium to low-end products. But aspiring entrepreneurs, investors, and researchers may want to note that we already have Miyoko's Kitchen, Follow Your Heart, and many other companies producing exceptional high-end products. So despite the significant impact of those artisan companies, what we need most, I think, is people tackling the mainstream animal products, those that make up most of our consumption, with plant-based alternatives. Labeling, marketing, and shelf space. One roadblock that is probably slowing down mainstream acceptance of plant-based products, even artisan ones, is labeling. When the California Department of Public Health inspected Schinner's production facility, the agent saw that the product was labeled only according to flavor, such as aged English fresh farmhouse. It couldn't be categorized as cheese, so the agent asked her for the actual name of the product. Schinner, on the spot, decided to call it a cultured nut product. While this was a snap decision, it has stuck, though Schinner is now moving toward mainstream dairy titles for her products when possible. For example, when her company launched its first butter in 2016, the name was unabashedly European-style cultured vegan butter. This name does include the word vegan, but that more reflects Schinner's desire to hold the vegan banner high than reservation about using the term butter alone. Plant-based milk producers are already facing legal challenges. The Standard of Identity for Milk defines it as the lacteal secretion practically free from colostrum, obtained by the complete milking of one or more healthy cows, which may be clarified, and may be adjusted by separating part of the fat therefrom. Concentrated milk, reconstituted milk, and dry, whole milk. Water, in a sufficient quantity to reconstitute concentrated and dry forms, may be added. These laws are necessary to help consumers easily identify different food products. If there were no criteria defining what makes ketchup, for example, we would have to constantly watch out for companies trying to peddle ketchup products made with improper ingredients or production methods. In the pre-industrialized world, it was much harder to fake food. Producers had little opportunity to substitute lesser ingredients, and most consumers grew their own food or knew the local farmers. They could often inspect the bakery, the crop field, or even the slaughterhouse if they wanted. Even then, food was subject to regulation. In ancient Rome, bread was sold on steps, and the higher the step, the higher the quality and price. This was originally done informally by merchants, but became required in the Theodosian Code of 438 CE. If you allowed bread to be moved from one step to another, you risked the severest punishment. This continues today. In 2011, two Spanish businessmen were sentenced to prison for selling olive oil that was actually 70-80% sunflower oil. In 2008, Chinese fraudsters added water to cow's milk used to produce infant formula while using the chemical melamine to increase the apparent protein content of the formula when tested. Nearly 300,000 babies fell ill. Approximately 53,000 were hospitalized, and 6 died. 11 countries stopped dairy imports from China after the incident. Such profit-driven food crimes are good reasons to enforce strict labeling standards. But the animal agriculture industry has also tried to twist the intent of these laws to drive up their own profits. Take soy milk, for example. This is an established product name that identifies a white milky beverage made from soy. I've never heard anyone wonder whether soy milk refers to soy-flavored cow's milk. Nonetheless, the dairy industry is waging a campaign to prevent plant-based milk producers from using milk to describe products such as soy and almond milk. They want the standard of identity enforced, seemingly just because it would harm their upstart competitor. It also seems the cow's milk industry is willing to throw other animal products under the bus, because the definition of milk specifies that it must come from a cow. The implication is that the beverage that comes from goat udders needs to be called something like goat juice. These labeling efforts are supported by U.S. congressional representatives from high dairy production states. As of this writing, they have received little support from other legislators, but this serves as a reminder of how industry affects policy and should make us hopeful about the support we can obtain for animal-free meat, dairy, and eggs once they become significant parts of at least some state economies. The fact is that the public's perception of milk is no longer aligned with its outdated legal definition, and food standards should be updated to reflect that. When the media reported on the 2016 and 2017 efforts by U.S. congresspersons from agricultural states to enforce the strict definition of the term, they spent less time in their articles discussing the proposed rule change than they did on the growing popularity of plant-based milks. An article by the Los Angeles Times editorial board used the headline, "Got Milk? Dairy Farmers Rage Against Imitators, But Consumers Know What They Want." And Yahoo Finance reported, "Dairy Farmers Are Losing the Battle Over Milk." In 2015, there was 9% growth in plant-based milk compared to a 7% decrease in dairy milk sales, making the plant-based milk market 10% the size of conventional milk. The dairy industry feels threatened, and it's lashing out by any means possible. Plant-based milk has been the most successful animal-free product on the market, despite the fact that it's one of the least emulative products in terms of nutrition. Soy is the only popular one with protein similar to animal-based milk. Plant-based milks often have lower sugar content than milk from animals, but the sweetened plant-based varieties, which have approximately the same sugar content as animal-based, are more popular. Some worry that added nutrients in plant-based milk, like calcium, are less easily absorbed by the human body. But others think this is misguided and that absorption rates are similar in both products. In the meat market, the leading plant-based products have nutritional and culinary profiles quite similar to animal-based products. Ethan Brown, CEO of Beyond Meat, argues that it makes sense to call his products meat. In an interview with TV personality Dr. Oz, he explained, "We like to use the language of plant-based meat, and what we're doing is we're taking all of the core constituent parts of meat. We're taking those directly from plants, basically protein, fat, and water. We're assembling those in the architecture of meat or muscle, and we're providing it to consumers in that form. So they're getting a piece of meat in terms of its constituent parts. It just doesn't come from an animal. The only differences, Brown argues, will be the nutritional benefits of the Beyond Burger. For example, it lacks cholesterol, which, despite being a common feature of animal meat, has no noticeable impact on taste or texture. There's also historical and contemporary precedent for using terms like meat outside of animal products, such as coconut meat, nut meat, and even the meat of the matter, to refer to the substance of an issue. We also say peanut butter and cocoa butter, terms that certainly aren't confusing consumers. To refer to plant-based meats as fake or alternative is not more accurate. It implies that animal-based meats are the gold standard in a way that doesn't properly reflect the ethical, health, and taste considerations, and doesn't reflect the common sense use of the relevant terms. In fact, a few years or decades down the road, we can hope to see labels and terminology that help consumers understand the harms of animal-based foods, similar to the cautionary text on cigarette cartons. We've already seen some restrictions on the misleading positive labels like humanely raised, though this is usually done without an explicit label, such as with picturesque farm images that in no way actually reflect the appearance of the vast majority of modern farms. Overall, I think there's a good case for calling the Beyond Burger meat without qualification. However, it would be concerning to me at this time if companies called soy milk, almond milk, and especially a product with a significantly different nutritional profile like coconut milk, tasty as it is, simply milk without identifying the plant it's derived from. But remember, that's not important for the current debate over the term, which concerns products such as those that are labeled almond milk and have pictures of almonds on the packaging. In those cases, it seems clear that consumers know what they're buying, and the dairy industry is simply trying to hassle a competing industry in an effort to bolster its tumbling sales. If the dairy industry has a genuine concern that consumers are missing out on protein, I'd note that the average American consumes far more than the recommended daily allowance of protein, around 145% the RDA for women, and 176% for men. We should also consider that our terminology is a way for producers to convey important social information about their product. By using meat to refer to plant-based foods with the same taste, texture, mouthfeel, and nutritional profile as animal flesh, we are telling people that they can get all those features without the animal cruelty, environmental devastation, and negative health impacts. At the time of this writing, Beyond Meat labels its burgers as plant-based without using the term meat. Ethan Brown told me that the company's current focus is on perfecting the product, and once it does that and public opinion data shows consumers are on board with this use of the term, they might switch. This seems like the right call, because consumers are still getting familiar with plant-based meats, and regulatory issues at this stage would be a big hassle. As the industry establishes itself and public attitudes shift, updated labeling will be an important stepping stone on the path toward an animal-free food system. Utilizing the obsession with animal-based foods in order to promote animal-free foods can go too far. Supermeat, a cultured meat company I will discuss in the next chapter, has used the line, "Meat is delicious, so delicious in fact, that we're not going to stop eating it." I think this is bad for the movement. Messages need to be kept simple, and most people who see this one probably won't appreciate that the meat it's referring to actually isn't made from animals. Even if they do, the message still implies that giving up meat is a loss. Fortunately, this sort of advertising is rare. Another example of animal-free advertising that might do more harm than good is a campaign by Ripple Foods. Ripple is a pioneering milk company that utilizes a patented protein purification process to extract plant protein without bringing along the plant flavor. They use yellow peas for this, the same vegetable Hampton Creek uses for its mayo. Ripple refers to its product as dairy-free milk, instead of identifying its specific protein source on the front of its package. This is easier to do for peas than nut-derived milks, because peas are not a common allergen, but mainly, it serves to emphasize that the product is not a plant-flavored product and to allow flexibility for Ripple to select different on-trend ingredients in their manufacturing. In general, Ripple is a very exciting company, especially given that its founders both helped lead and learned lessons from two other clean tech movements, Neil Renninger with renewable fuels and Adam Lowry with sustainable household cleaning products. When I spoke with Renninger in his company's lab near San Francisco, he seemed emboldened by the failures of renewable fuels, eager to avoid that movement's mistakes. By and large, I think Ripple is doing that successfully. Renninger was particularly excited to move into food technology because the food and beverage industry spends an extremely low amount on R&D, around 1% of sales, while other sectors spend closer to 5 to 10%, and many innovative Silicon Valley companies spend up to 20 to 25%. It's an industry ripe for innovation. When I tried Ripple's milk and yogurt, the products definitely stood out to me as some of the closest replications of animal-based milk on the market today, though a fellow taste tester disliked the milk, remarking that it tasted like peas. My concern about Ripple is that its marketing strategy includes disparaging some of its plant-based colleagues. In response to the dairy campaign to restrict the use of the term milk, Ripple launched a website saying, "Dear Dairy, I can understand why you're upset. Almond milk is a sham. Only 1 gram of protein and less than a handful of almonds in an entire bottle? That's not milk. Cashew and coconut milk are even worse. They don't have any protein." The campaign shows viewers an 8-bit style game where the user answers questions about what milk should be, such as, should milk shower you in sugar? It displays an ongoing race next to the questions, and with each answer you give, Ripple inches farther ahead of the competition. Oddly, even if you say you want the sugar and other seemingly undesirable features, it still concludes that Ripple is a better fit. I think this is a poor approach. While it's true that Ripple is a great plant-based option for consumers who want the same nutritional profile as dairy without dairy's downsides, I think the animal-free food industry thrives and withers together. If consumers are genuinely misinformed about the nutritional aspect, I haven't seen data that they are, then educating them is useful, but not through attacking those products with an adversarial marketing campaign. This is especially true if the misinformation is about protein, as Renninger has suggested, given the typical overconsumption of protein in the American diet. Negative campaigns like Ripple's might boost short-term attention of an individual company, and perhaps profits as well, but runs a significant risk of impeding the whole industry's long-term growth, and likely even the growth of the company utilizing the negative messaging. Pat Brown, CEO of Impossible Foods, has made a similar mistake, in my opinion, in calling cultured meat one of the stupidest ideas ever expressed. He's not an expert on this technology, and clearly many of his scientific peers are much more optimistic. In the field of cellular agriculture, growing agricultural products with cells rather than whole organisms, some of the entrepreneurs I interviewed told me about issues they had getting funding in Silicon Valley explicitly due to Pat Brown's negative views and influence in that community. Pat's other comment on cultured meat, that you buy into at best the same limitations that a cow has, makes it clear he doesn't really understand the technology, which is exciting precisely because it frees us from the limitations of animal biology. I'm glad Pat Brown is working hard on plant-based meat, but his sweeping dismissal of promising alternative technology is unwarranted. An issue similar to labeling and advertising, and one that we likely must tackle for the industry to successfully jolt consumers out of the status quo, is shelf space and placement. Literally, where the products sit in the grocery store. This was key in the stunning sales growth we've seen of plant-based milks. In 2002, Dean Foods, a massive food and beverage company specializing in dairy products, bought White Wave, makers of the popular Silk soy milk brand. With the resources of Dean Foods, Silk got additional shelf space in grocery stores, specifically space right next to the animal-based milk. This simple change made the product much more accessible. And as much as we consumers want to believe that we are not influenced by something as trivial as shelf placement, having to walk across the grocery store to find a new product is a big deterrent. Beyond Meat has been the first plant-based meat producer to achieve such premium shelf space, now stocking its patties in the meat case at Whole Foods. There is also psychological evidence that vegetarian food will benefit from being incorporated into restaurant menus' main selections, as opposed to being listed in a separate vegetarian section. Changes like this should also be a priority of animal-free food companies and activists. Plant butchers. In addition to the large plant-based companies discussed thus far, small businesses are taking their own piece of the pie. Take, for example, the vegan sister-brother duo of Aubrey and Kale Walsh. Yes, that's his real name. One day, in casual conversation with friends, Aubrey half-jokingly suggested that they open a vegan butcher shop. The idea grew on them. So Aubrey and Kale, just 34 and 22 respectively at the time, worked together to launch the herbivorous butcher at the Minneapolis Farmers Market in June 2014. The butchers quickly earned a loyal and dedicated local fan base thanks to their quality cuts like Italian sausage and huli huli Hawaiian ribs, as well as their hook of being America's first vegan butcher shop. The duo's chipper personalities helped too. This momentum enabled them to raise over $60,000 on the crowdfunding website Kickstarter to open a brick-and-mortar storefront. Since their Kickstarter campaign, Aubrey and Kale have received international media coverage in top outlets including NPR, Time, The Telegraph, and The Guardian. They were even featured in an episode of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives with celebrity chef Guy Fieri. While the herbivorous butcher might not grow to become the next Beyond Meat, their team is impact-driven and has made a significant difference in their local community, as well as to their online customers and the audience they reach through media coverage. As the animal-free food economy grows, there will be room for an army of small businesses like theirs, who could collectively form a branch of the movement every bit as strong as the bigger companies. So motivated readers should take note. What's your business idea? 5. The world's first cultured hamburger. On Friday, August 2, 2013, the temperature in the Dutch city of Maastricht reached a record high of 94 degrees. That afternoon, Mark Post biked home from the tissue engineering laboratory at Maastricht University with around $600,000 worth of meat in an icebox on the back of his bike. He was carrying two of the first hamburgers ever made from cell-cultured beef, meat grown from animal cells outside of an animal's body. They were to be shipped to London over the weekend for a televised public tasting on Monday. To many advocates, this event felt like the beginning of the end of animal farming. The technological ability to grow meat like this might be new, but visionaries have been expecting this development for at least 80 years. In his 1931 essay, 50 Years Hence, Winston Churchill predicted, "We shall escape the absurdity of growing a whole chicken in order to eat the breast or wing by growing these parts separately under a suitable medium." The scientific foundations of this prediction began decades prior, in 1885, when zoologist Wilhelm Roux extracted tissue from a live chicken embryo and maintained it in warm saline solution for several days. Starting in 1912, the French surgeon Alexis Carrel sustained a piece of embryonic chicken heart tissue for 34 years. There was little progress for the next few decades, which didn't bode well for Churchill's prediction. That changed in the 1970s, when researchers started growing muscle fibers in vitro, meaning they extracted small samples of tissue from animals, placed them in culture media, a bath of nutrients and growth molecules for the cell, and saw a significant size increase. Some scientists, such as Russell Ross, did this with aortic tissue from young guinea pigs to better understand atherosclerosis, a disease characterized by plaques in the arteries which can lead to heart attack and stroke. Cultured meat is the term I'll use for any animal cells grown outside an animal's body for human consumption, but it's sometimes referred to as cell-cultured meat, cell-based meat, in vitro meat, lab-grown meat, and clean meat. By 1981, the year Churchill predicted that we would be growing cultured meat, no scientific team was working to culture muscle fibers for human consumption. It wasn't until 1995 that another advocate, Willem van Eelen, took up the cause by filing patents for cultured meat in the U.S., the Netherlands, and other countries. Van Eelen was held as a prisoner of war as a 17-year-old soldier in World War II, and during that period, he became intimately familiar with intense human suffering, especially hunger, as he was tasked with divvying out rice to his fellow prisoners. He witnessed his captors abuse animals in much the same way they abused him, sparking a lifelong interest in reducing animal suffering. After his release, Van Eelen went to university in the Netherlands and met a biology professor who kept alive a large piece of meat in vitro, like Cajrel had done in 1912. After college, Van Eelen managed art galleries and restaurants, but he toyed with the idea of cultured meat for most of his adult life and attempted some unsuccessful lab work that led to patents in the late 1990s. The next milestone in the field came in 1998, when a team of American engineers funded by NASA grew goldfish meat in vitro. Their goal was to better understand the viability of cultured meat as a way to feed astronauts. The fish fillets they successfully produced were fried with olive oil, garlic, lemon, and pepper, but the researchers never tasted them since consumption wasn't allowed by the FDA, presumably because it hadn't been tested for food safety. Lead engineer Morris Benjaminson observed that they looked and smelled just like fish fillets. The NASA research was discontinued because the cell-based food was expensive to produce and seemed like too much of a moonshot. The first cultured meat that people admit to eating was part of the work of Australian artist Oron Katz in 2003. In 2000, he prototyped a semi-living steak from prenatal sheep skeletal cells, and 3 years later, his team exhibited at L'Art Biotech in France with cultured frog meat, serving it to 6 guests to draw attention to the kind of hypocrisy needed in order to be able to love and respect living things as well as to eat them. This work and similar art projects are drawing praise from some in the cellular agriculture field for exploring the boundaries of this fascinating new technology. Another artistic team produced the In Vitro Meat Cookbook, which includes illustrations of knitted meat, meat ice cream, and other strange cultured meat dishes. I worry that this sort of art makes the technology seem a bit absurd, more like a quirky experiment than a viable solution to our broken food system. That being said, it is fun to imagine the possibilities. In 2004, Van Eelen, who referred to himself as the godfather of in vitro meat, kicked off the modern era of cultured meat research. The Promethean businessman contacted scientists at Utrecht University and Eindhoven University of Technology in the Netherlands, trying to convince them to apply for a research grant from the Dutch government. The scientists were persuaded by the very charismatic 81-year-old entrepreneur, as was the Dutch government. He also recruited Peter Verstrada, a meat industry professional, to serve as the research program administrator. As the research project began, the aforementioned Mark Post was working one day a week at Eindhoven on unrelated research, but when the local cultured meat program manager fell ill, Post was happy to step in. He supervised 2 PhD students and found that most of the other scientists were working on the project for reasons other than food production, such as medical applications of cell culturing technology. Eventually, the press caught wind of the research and began contacting the scientists for quotes and information. One reporter from the Sunday Times, the largest traditional newspaper in the UK, tried contacting two scientists in 2009 before finally reaching Post. That happenstance coverage made Post, a relative newcomer, the go-to contact for the topic in the flood of news articles that followed. During this deluge, Post received an email from Rob Featherston Haugh, whom Post assumed was just another reporter. Featherston Haugh asked the usual questions about the research, like where the cells came from, and asked if he could visit him in person. Again, not an unusual request. On May 5, 2011, Post met with Featherston Haugh and discussed his ambitious plans for growing the field. Post wanted to raise interest in cultured meat with a public tasting, perhaps of a few links of sausage, a relatively easy meat product compared to steak or pork belly. He envisioned the taste testers on stage with the happy and healthy pig from whom the cells were taken. Post hoped such an event would generate enough funding to scale up and commercialize the technology. At the end of the conversation, Post was happily surprised to learn that his visitor represented the co-founder of Google, Sergey Brin, who wanted to fund the public tasting as part of his mission to support world-changing tech ventures. Eventually, Post and Brin's team settled on a hamburger prototype and decided not to bring the cow on stage. The timeline for the event grew longer due to unexpected issues like the meat not binding together properly at the scale of the burger, monumental compared to the tiny scientific samples previously made in the lab. Lab technicians combined muscle fibers from thousands of these samples, totaling around 40 billion cells, with red beet juice, saffron, breadcrumbs, and egg to create the hamburger patties. This process is very labor-intensive. Indeed, some of the scientists I've spoken with in the field find the process of creating prototypes to be quite frustrating. It takes a huge amount of work, and while it's useful for funding and publicity, it rarely helps generate any real scientific knowledge. The media used to grow the fibers included fetal bovine serum, an ethically problematic and expensive product made from the blood of cow fetuses. While it's used in research, this component is not viable for commercial production as it's prohibitively expensive. Researchers have instead focused on inexpensive plant-based versions, though improving them is an active area of research. Finally, on August 5, 2013, the tasting setup was ready. The hamburger stayed intact, even while being transported by bike on the hottest day of the year. The public tasting opened with a video of Brin, an anthropologist and an environmentalist hyping the transformative nature of the technology. Post, the chef, and two journalist taste testers shared their excitement about the burger, which was carefully cooked with sunflower oil and butter. Then the tasting began. The first reaction, after a long chew, was, "I was expecting the texture to be more soft," followed by concerns about the lack of fat and seasoning. But the overall conclusion was that it was close to meat, and that it was certainly impressive as a first step, especially given the burger itself was only muscle cells, no fat. New Harvest. The Good Food Institute has helped grow the plant-based and cellular agriculture industries since 2015. But the nonprofit organization New Harvest has been hand-rearing cellular agriculture since 2004. If Van Eelen is that industry's godfather, New Harvest's founder, Jason Matheny, is the doctor who delivered the baby and provided expert care in its infancy. Prior to 2004, Matheny earned his Master of Public Health from Johns Hopkins University and worked as a consultant for the World Bank and Center for Global Development. Like many people who take an interest in effective altruism, he was motivated by the utilitarian philosophy he was exposed to in university. After Matheny visited a poultry farm in India, he became convinced that he needed to tackle the issue of animal farming. He read about the NASA goldfish experiments and contacted all 60 of the authors cited therein to discuss the possibility of large-scale cultured meat production. Matheny realized that cultured meat sat in an academic no-man's land at the intersection of food production and medical technology, the latter of which is where most tissue engineering research occurs. This neglect made it difficult for researchers to find sustainable funding and institutional support, so Matheny founded New Harvest in 2004 to help. New Harvest's first big win was helping Van Eelen convince the Dutch agriculture minister to support the research effort he facilitated. In 2006, New Harvest raised an additional sum from private donors to support the research, and in 2008, they helped with the world's first international in vitro meat symposium in Norway. New Harvest continued hosting workshops and coordinating research all the way until the cultured hamburger launch in 2013. In fact, they were the ones who originally referred Sergey Brin to Mark Post as a potential grantee. At that point, Matheny moved on to a new high-impact role in intelligence research for the U.S. government, based on the same effective altruism motivations, and another young leader took the wheel at New Harvest. In 2009, Isha Datar was in her senior year at the University of Alberta, where she was studying cellular and molecular biology. She took a graduate-level course on meat science and was galvanized by what she learned about the harm of animal farming. After her professor attended one of New Harvest's seminars and told the class about the prospect of cultured meat, Datar wrote her term paper on the topic, which snowballed her enthusiasm. She reached out to Matheny, who helped her publish the term paper in the journal Innovative Food Science and Emerging Technologies. Since Datar took over as executive director in 2013, New Harvest's work has kicked into high gear. One of her first projects was founding a company to work on an easier project than cultured meat, cultured milk. She reached out to two people in her network who had expressed an interest in making real milk without cows, recent graduates Ryan Panja from Tufts University and Parimal Gandhi from Stony Brook University. These three young scientists had only 4 days to coordinate before the application deadline of a biotechnology-focused startup accelerator that could provide them with lab space, mentorship, and $30,000 in seed funding. They were accepted as the New Harvest Dairy Project and quickly packed their bags to move to Ireland for the summer. Thanks to the hype around Post's Burger and New Harvest's workshops, biotech investors were eager to hop on board. Then journalists learned of the project and a media barrage followed, which led to more investor interest. The team then traveled to Hong Kong to meet with Horizons Ventures, the venture capital firm funded by Li Ka-shing, whose investment in Hampton Creek was discussed in an earlier chapter. In one summer, the company, now called Perfect Day, received more attention than many successful startups do after several years of existence. Perfect Day, originally launched as Moo-Free after its incubation period, claims the process for milk is much easier than that for cultured meat, primarily because milk is acellular. This means that instead of growing whole cells, Panja and Gandhi only have to grow the dairy proteins casein and whey. You might know casein as the culprit of cheese's addictive nature, and whey for its popularity in dairy-based protein shakes. Perfect Day makes these proteins with the same process used to make insulin for diabetics and to make chymosin, the main constituent of rennet, a common cheese ingredient originally taken from the stomachs of young calves. It's also the same process used for the heme in the Impossible Burger. The process involves taking the genes that encode a molecule's production, whether that's casein, whey, insulin, or chymosin, and inserting them into microorganisms like yeast. The microorganisms are not included in the final product, so the final product is the exact same molecule you would get from farming cows for their milk, refuting any health concerns. For insulin, this gene insertion process has made the life-saving medicine much less expensive. For animal products, it provides a useful tool for fixing our broken food system. Before founding Perfect Day, Pandya also toyed with the idea of making an artificial udder with tissue engineering technology, but the yeast idea was much simpler with more commercial precedent. They even named their dairy yeast Buttercup. In 2016, I had the opportunity to visit Perfect Day's headquarters in Berkeley. The company had just moved into a new location, where I had to slide past workers giving the entrance a fresh coat of paint. It was a typical open office Silicon Valley startup headquarters, but in the back was a laboratory space that looked just like the lab desks in a high school chemistry classroom. Pandya told me how in high school he learned about the immense suffering of farmed animals. The connection between his dinner plate and animal cruelty made him deeply uncomfortable, and he considered vegetarianism, but he also faced peer pressure that ultimately dissuaded him. Then Pandya spent the summer before college as a camp counselor with a friend who was also interested in vegetarianism. Since college was a fresh start, Pandya and his friend took the plunge. That fall, he read Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer and realized that the animal cruelty arguments for vegetarianism also applied to replacing dairy and eggs, so he became vegan-ish. His compromise was that one day a week he could enjoy an eggplant parmesan, but after each meal, he'd question if this small indulgence was worth it. Later in his college career, he took a course on tissue engineering and had his light bulb moment when he considered the possibility of engineering animal-free animal products. He saw this as a high-impact role in the movement that might be neglected because it requires not just ethical motivation, but also scientific knowledge and an entrepreneurial spirit, a trifecta that describes Pandya perfectly. Pandya contacted New Harvest for advice, and after graduation he worked on acquiring lab experience by working for a small biotech firm that made vaccines using the same gene insertion process that Perfect Day would end up using. He moved into an entrepreneur house with the pitch of making an animal-free milk company. That's when Dattar told him about the accelerator deadline and connected him with his co-founder, Gandhi, another young scientist who went vegetarian in sixth grade after receiving a pro-vegetarian leaflet in India. A laboratory fridge at Perfect Day's office held a dozen or so samples of yogurt in small mason jars. As with the Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods burgers, I struggled to find something to complain about when I tried one. In my opinion, plant-based yogurts already mimic animal-based yogurt pretty effectively. Perhaps the one distinction I could notice was that this yogurt had more of the fat and richness common in the average dairy yogurt, similar to what whole milk has that skim milk lacks. I think most plant-based yogurts have particularly low fat content, because the companies want to appeal to health-focused consumers. Like my friend at Impossible, Pandya was far more critical of his own product. He estimated that Perfect Day was 70% of the way to matching artisanal animal-based yogurts. They had figured out most of the tongue flavor, like sour and salty notes, but weren't quite there with the retronasal depth of milk fat, and they hadn't fully captured the subtle grassy notes of their target brand, Liberté. Fortunately, their head of food development, Ravi Jhala, has 15 years of experience working in the flavor department of big dairy brands like Sargento, Blue Bunny, and Chobani, so I'm optimistic that they'll reach these taste goals. The development of cultured animal products has been seen as a silver bullet since its inception. In 2008, PETA announced a $1 million prize for the first team of scientists to produce large quantities of affordable cultured chicken meat. Up until the last few years, most were still skeptical that this could happen, but ever since the cultured hamburger and Perfect Day's founding, the movement has flourished with a newfound optimism, with many advocates frustrated by the seemingly slow pace of social change, believing that this new technology will cut the Gordian knot of factory farming. A quickly increasing number of startups have been founded in this space since those landmark events. Dattar and New Harvest started another one in 2014 by again connecting two aspiring entrepreneurs in their network, David Anchel and Arturo Elizondo. This team quickly applied to an accelerator too, IndieBio in San Francisco. They initially called themselves the New Harvest Egg Project, and they utilize a similar process to Perfect Day in order to produce the roughly 12 key proteins found in egg whites. They were accepted to IndieBio, produced high-quality samples of animal-free meringues, and raised $1.75 million in seed funding before the end of the program. They now go by Clara Foods. Geltor, another company to come out of IndieBio, produces the structural protein collagen, which is found in connective tissue and most commonly used in gelatin, an animal product we rarely think of, but which is a $3 billion to $5 billion industry. Alex Loristani, co-founder of Geltor, told me he decided to focus on collagen due to not only its neglectedness, but because of the industrial applications, which provide a solid, incremental model for scaling up. Collagen is used in numerous non-food industries, such as cosmetics, pharmaceuticals, and materials, and a common complaint is that collagen from animal farming has impurities and imperfections that are costly to fix at a large scale. Cellular agriculture excels at producing a pure, homogeneous product. Loristani, like Renninger at Ripple Foods, designs his business strategy with an eye to the failed biofuels industry of the past decade, meaning he's wary of aiming for a big commodity market without a clear ladder of profitable business outcomes to get there. In fact, Geltor already started selling collagen in 2017. Their work, in my opinion, not only benefits their future prospects, but also sets useful precedent for the food-only cellular agriculture companies that don't have the same ladder available. Loristani told me that his motivation was different from that of many of the other activists and entrepreneurs. He had less moral and ethical outrage with the issue and instead had a technical outrage. He said that current production methods were, in scientific terms, the dumbest way to make the things that we need and love. There are several communities of biohackers working on smaller cellular agriculture projects, such as Real Vegan Cheese working out of Counterculture Labs and BioCurious in California. These community research centers play an important role in providing education to young scientists and jump-starting larger biotechnology projects. The applications of cellular agriculture extend beyond the food system. Sothic Bioscience is producing LAL, limulus amoebocyte lysate, an unfamiliar but important compound that the medical industry uses to test for the presence of harmful bacteria. Until a company like Sothic succeeds, LAL will be made from the blood of Atlantic horseshoe crabs with an invasive process at such a scale that it puts the species at risk for extinction as early as 2019. Other companies are applying cellular agriculture to the materials industry. The most well-known of these is Modern Meadow, which originally focused on both meat and leather. With their current focus on leather, which they see as an easier scientific and marketing project that can pave the way for food products, they use gene insertion to produce collagen and let that collagen combine and grow into a full hide that is tanned just like an animal's. Modern Meadow estimates commercial release in 2019, though it probably won't be selling directly to consumers. Similarly, Bolt Threads and Spiber are producing silk products with proteins made from microbes. These products are already on the market, but aren't currently affordable. Bolt Threads sold a limited edition series of 50 ties at $314 each. The cellular agriculture industry today is an exciting confluence of nonprofits, engineers, biologists, and entrepreneurs working across a variety of industries with a variety of skills and perspectives. The cultured meat arms race. There are now four main cultured meat companies vying to reach hungry consumers. The first is Mosameat, the company founded by Mark Post and Peter Verstrata, whom we met earlier in the chapter, to commercialize their research results. Second is Memphis Meats, The most well-known company today, thanks in large part to their viral videos of prototype meatballs, chicken tenders, and duck à l'orange strips released in 2016 and 2017. I first met Memphis's co-founder and CEO, Uma Valetti, in 2015 at the Effective Altruism Global Conference at Google's headquarters in San Francisco. I was presenting on effective altruism for animals, and Valetti was giving a talk on cultured meat, which many effective altruists regard as a highly cost-effective way to do good in the world. Valetti is a prominent leader in cellular agriculture with an exceptionally level-headed approach. He studied at one of India's top medical schools, then applied for a visa to finish his education at the famous Mayo Clinic in the U.S. He was rejected several times, so he went to study in Jamaica with plans to practice in the U.K. There, he met his future wife and finally had his visa accepted on his seventh try. He moved to the U.S. and pursued a career as a cardiologist while his wife worked as a pediatric eye surgeon. Valetti has wanted to help animals since he was a child. At the age of 12, he remembers attending a friend's birthday party in India, where celebration was happening in the front yard with dishes like chicken tandoori, while animals were slaughtered in the backyard to feed the happy guests. Valetti refers to this as his birthday-death day experience when speaking to supporters and journalists. When he started learning about stem cell treatments as a cardiologist, his mind kept drifting to animal agriculture and the possibility of growing meat outside of an animal's body. He contacted Matheny and eventually joined the New Harvest Board of Directors in 2013. He helped search for people to take up the project of cultured meat, until finally his wife and kids told him, "You've been talking about this for a while. You're asking other people to do it. Why are you not doing it?" So he moved to Silicon Valley and started a cultured meat company. One of Valetti's co-founders is Nicholas Genovese, who had previously worked in cultured meat research thanks to a grant from PETA. Genovese also had experience raising poultry on his family's farm. The other co-founder is Will Clem, a tissue engineer who left that career in 2012 to found and manage a Memphis area restaurant chain called Baby Jack's Barbecue. His family founded the Witt's Barbecue chain of over 40 restaurants in Alabama and Tennessee, so Clem is well positioned to help Memphis Meats commercialize their products in the Memphis barbecue scene. As discussed in the previous chapter, it's critical for new animal-free foods to target the masses of American consumers, not just the mostly liberal, high-income, ethics, and health-focused consumers who are already eating animal-free food. In June 2017, the plant-based food leader Hampton Creek announced it was joining the race for cultured meat. The company had actually been working on cellular agriculture for over a year, a fact well known to researchers and advocates in the field, but kept secret until the company had more confidence in their process and a timeline for commercial launch. In fact, the company told journalists the first products would be out in late 2018, a remarkably short schedule. Memphis Meats had previously discussed 2021 for the release of its first products, and only in the same month as Hampton Creek's announcement did it push its timeline forward to 2019. Each company is vying for first-mover advantage, securing distribution channels, investor support, and public attention. In this new market, one key factor will be selling technology to and working with the big meat and food companies. As I've discussed, traditional food companies might be averse to innovate themselves due to the novelty of cultured meat and the speculative timelines of cultured meat technology. However, it seems far more likely that they will dive in once products begin hitting the marketplace. Reaching the marketplace and meeting these deadlines are actually easier than most people think. It could be one product, sold at just one restaurant for just a few days with a high price tag, being sold at a loss for the company. When it comes to actually scaling up, in the same way big food companies have an advantage over startups in post-innovation production and distribution, Hampton Creek has this advantage over the newer, less established companies like Memphis Meats. Perhaps most important, Hampton Creek's plant-based R&D has given them tens of millions of dollars worth of infrastructure and testing and cataloging thousands of plant ingredients. I discussed this work with Hampton Creek's Director of Cellular Agriculture, Aiton Fisher, who agreed, saying that if he wanted to build a brand new company to work on cultured meat, his first project would be to build exactly this infrastructure. The main purpose of this is to develop an inexpensive, highly effective growth media for the cell cultures. Fisher explained that all the cost models of companies in the field point to media as the limiting factor for large-scale cultured meat production. Fisher is a longtime effective altruist whom I met while he was completing his law degree at Stanford, and he echoes the dedication and ambition of Hampton Creek founders Josh Balk and Josh Tetrick. He's a quiet, intellectual young person who originally planned to pursue either corporate law, intending to donate most of his salary to animal charities, or academia, so he could share important ideas like animal ethics with law students. However, when he realized the promise of cellular agriculture, Fisher pivoted 180 degrees to a career in food technology. He saw that Hampton Creek could help push cultured meat to market years ahead of schedule, quite possibly sparing billions of animals. Before all of this, Fisher co-founded Animal Charity Evaluators, the effective altruism research organization where I used to work. He has never sought the spotlight, but his dedication and talent has made huge strides for the movement. Hampton Creek is focusing on cultured poultry, largely because poultry farming has one of the greatest ethical costs. In the long term, Fisher says they hope to build a multi-species, multi-product platform spanning the entire range of meat and seafood. If I had to place a bet on which company will be first to bring cultured meat to market, and to be its forerunner as the industry expands, Hampton Creek would be my first choice. Another possibility is that Tyson Foods will swoop into the market and take the lead, though that would likely be done through a partnership with a company like Hampton Creek. It could also be another food giant like Purdue. In fact, Josh Balk used to investigate and expose animal cruelty in Purdue's chicken meat supply chain, but by 2017, he was in talks with Purdue about how the company can invest in cultured meat. The fourth cultured meat company is the brainchild of the animal rights revolution in Israel. The amazing progress seen in Israel in the last few years is commonly discussed in the global movement, though it's not entirely clear what they did to be so successful. Based on my conversations with Israeli advocates, it seems the revolution kicked off in 2011, when two animal advocates, Daniel Ehrlich and Chovav Amir, added Hebrew subtitles to an online video of a presentation by American animal advocate Gary Yourofsky. The clickbait-titled video, "The Best Speech You'll Ever Hear," was of a college presentation at Georgia Tech in 2010. Yourofsky is known in the animal rights movement for his bold language with explicit comparisons of slavery, Jewish persecution, and animal farming, even calling slaughterhouses concentration camps. The two young advocates who subtitled Yourofsky's video worked hard to make it go viral in Israel. They handed out literature on the streets, shared the video through existing activist networks, and even persuaded a tofu company to print a link to Yourofsky's site on their packaging. The movement rocketed into mainstream discourse thanks to that viral video. Popular food critic Ori Shavit went vegan and became a figurehead for the movement. Vegan activist Tal Gilboa won the Israeli version of the Big Brother reality TV competition. Beyond that, why has the movement taken flight so rapidly in Israel? Israel seems like a country primed for animal rights messaging. Israeli advocates think the history of persecution helps people immediately sympathize with animal suffering. Their culture praises bluntness and strong language more than Western Europe and the U.S. The most common religious practices involve numerous dietary restrictions, unlike the "I'll eat anything" culture of many other countries. Once Yourofsky's speech kindled the activism networks organized in the prior decade, the resulting forest fire spread quickly through Israel. In 2013, when Israeli advocates heard of the cultured hamburger, some with biology and engineering backgrounds knew they had to get into cellular agriculture, and other young advocates entered those fields specifically for this reason.